Cal, I don't think I can do this. Lead them. I can't. I'm not the man you are. I don't belong here. Not only in this position. I don't know that I belong as a Radiant. I know the concern you show for each soldier. You're the person for this position. You're going to do a storming fine job of it, Sigzel. Commander of the Windrunners. Having said it like that, Kaladin felt the final separation and found peace in it. I thought that was a really good final separation scene between Kaladin and Sigzel. I'd be willing to bet that Kaladin and Sigzel no longer... that this is the last scene between Kaladin and Sigzel, or at least it certainly feels like that. Welcome back to Following Know It on a Stormlight Podcast. This week is chapters 12, 13, and our first two interludes for Wind and Truth by Brandon Sanderson. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing well. Man, these interludes are a doozy.
Yeah, just real quick on the interludes. Way back, you could even say all the way through Oathbringer, interludes have nothing to do with the story. Like, they might come involved, like, you know, 40 chapters later, like, oh yeah, there was some scholars watching a flame spread, and now that's relevant. No, these are just chapters. They're just chapters.
Well, and while we're talking about this, I actually, so at the beginning of the book, when I picked up my physical copy not all that long ago, I was flipping through the front pages, and actually I avoided the list of art because it says on the top of that page, like, hey, don't read this page. There's spoilers here. But the page before that is the table of contents. I did read that. We have a lot of interludes ahead of us, like a lot, because supposedly this book is now split into 10 days, not five parts, but we're getting interludes in between every single one. So we have potentially twice the amount of interludes ahead of us as we've ever seen before.
As a serial interlude lover, I'm so excited. And I'm so excited to talk to y'all about these interludes. These are just our first two.
Our first two. Paul, do you have two words to... How are you, first of all?
I do have two how are you words. I'm doing good. Excited, like I said, very excited to talk about the interludes. Ever since Ishik's interlude in The Way of Kings, I've been hooked on these interludes.
He's my on my bingo card.
Yeah, my attention just goes way up. I tune in. I'm so excited. My two words, one is surprises, because I was simply surprised by our interlude characters. And very enthusiastic, surprised by some of our Worldhopper characters, the things going on. And my other word is puppeteer. There's a common theory going, not maybe common, but a theory going around about cultivation kind of being the mastermind behind everything here. And we have a lot of fuel to add to that fire, in my opinion. To view one of you cultivation as the puppeteer of our story.
Elliot, do you have two words?
I do have two words. My two words for these chapters are going rogue. And I grabbed it for the main inspiration is actually the Oathgate Spren that Shallan talks to and kind of has a realization of, oh, there are other Spren out there in the world kind of going rogue and are not necessarily on the I'm on nobody's side, you know, kind of thing for the Spren. But then also in our interludes is Odium going rogue. I feel like Odium's been going rogue like this whole time. That's maybe Odium's thing, but still doing that. And then Kalak manages to get himself nabbed by a rogue agent.
Elliot, we must be brothers, because in the preview chapters when I covered with Elliot, or with not Elliot, with Tim and David, I used that same phrase.
Of
I'm on nobody's side because nobody's on my side, talking about the Oathgate Spren. So yeah, we must be related.
Wow. I wanted to point out that Elliot's words were going rogue, and I would like to amend my words now to, instead of going rogue, to be going beast mode. So those are my new words.
That's three words.
But
we're hyphenating. Cheating.
Hyphen. Yes, it's all hyphenated. It's actually one word.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't have any explanation further than that, other than we're going beast mode in this episode.
Paul, do we have a patron?
We do, yes, and I'm actually very excited to announce. So we have an Ardent this week, and I'll go ahead and introduce our new Ardent. I believe it's a series of letters, which I know most words are, but this is one that was harder to read. Trevor's laughing at me already.
You broke him.
I believe
that funny, but whatever.
I believe it is pronounced Hunter, but there's no vowels. So we have H-N-T-R-W. So I'm assuming that's Hunter W. So a very cool, a W Hunter, you know, for the win. And we're much appreciated. We much appreciate your support. We have Hunter W as an Ardent. And the joke I was going to come up with was that, you know, being a hunter and an ardent is probably a really interesting dichotomy of roles in life to do both. So that's very exciting, and we much appreciate your support. I'm going with Hunter. I'm going to stick with that. You're welcome to comment, be like, no, it's H-N-T-R, you idiot. And I'd be like, okay, you're right. I'm sorry. I tried to make it into a word. But I ramble on and on and on, but we much appreciate your support in all of our patrons. We say that over and over, but it really is special and cool. Yeah, there you have it. Thank you, Hunter.
Thank you.
Thank you. If I had two words, which nobody ever asked for mine, but I run the podcast, that's probably my fault.
Boo-hoo. Those are your words.
I would say divided one. Divided one. I am so excited about Immune yes. 2 because Teravangian titles himself the Divided One, which is awesome. I talked about this a little bit in like our most viewed episode or video or whatever. It was actually a solo video without you two. It was our most viewed, so just like to put that out there. But my Stormlight key scenes tier list that I made like 2.5 years ago or whatever, I went on a little rant about how Brandon Sanderson was brilliant for right at the end of Rhythm of War twisting Odium into a new villain, and the stakes completely change at the end of Rhythm of War, because up until now you're getting used to Odium, you can kind of figure him out. Raze has his weaknesses, we figure that out. Swap him for Teravangian. Now everything is on the table. Like nothing that we knew beforehand is the same, which I think is so cool. So Teravangian, Odium, Todium as a concept, love it. This is our first point of view from him, and he titles himself the Divided One. Yeah.
This is incredibly epic. Are we good to go ahead and talk about that interlude? Can we?
No. That? We need to end with that.
No, come on. Trevor, it's not about you. It's for the listeners.
Yeah, they can skip to the end, and that's what they'll... All right, we're going to put it in the middle so that they can't skip around.
I lied. It's not for the listeners, Trevor. It was for me. I was trying to scapegoat and use our friends and our listeners to get my wish.
No, we're going to talk about Chapter 12 and 13. You can wait.
Oh.
Okay. We have... Chapter 12, Kaladin saying farewell to Bridge 4 before he departs Urethiru. And Kaladin, up until this point, this is actually referenced back to Words of Radiance, the beginning of Words of Radiance, where Bridge 4 all get the Bridge 4 tattoo on their forehead. But for whatever reason, we now know, but for whatever reason at the time, it doesn't take on Kaladin. Like, the tattoo sits there for a second, but then Stormlight heals it off of him. And I think this is what pretty well confirmed in this chapter, but the idea behind it was Kaladin still views himself as Shash branded. Kaladin still views himself as oppressed, as a slave, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So his Stormlight will then heal him to have those brands on his head, because that's how he views himself.
For me, I think it was also like a worthiness thing. He never sees himself as worthy of the men of Bridge Four. And I think there's some moments in these chapters where he finally accepts, like, I did a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. And so, yeah, in this chapter, Kaladin finally does get his Bridge Four tattoo on his forehead before he leaves Urithiru, which I actually think is kind of funny, because in Rhythm of War, if you guys remember, under the occupied tower, all of the occupants of the tower get like a Shash brand on their forehead in like solidarity for Kaladin, because that's what Kaladin has, and they're like trying to get behind him as their liberator or whatever. And then like weeks later, his Shash brand disappears after everybody's got like a Shash brand tattoo on their forehead. It's like, well, now you don't match everybody who's your fan, and now he has a Bridge Four tattoo. But anyway,
like the no regrets tattoo, but yes, the other exactly. People can't heal theirs off, you know, so they're all walking around with it, which was a great thing in Rhythm of War. I can't discount that, but it is really comical that now Kaladin doesn't have it and all these other people do,
right,
to try and support Kaladin.
There was a couple lines in here that I thought were really good, and any Bridge Four content I'm happy for, which I'm not sure we're going to get much else ever after this chapter. So this chapter was nice to have, but there were some very good Sigsil lines that foreshadow Sunlit Man. So if you haven't read Sunlit Man, here's some minor spoilers, but Sigsil is in Sunlit Man and he has a couple of lines with Kaladin here, and I want to read them. It starts with, "Sir," Sigsil said, I don't think I can do this. Lead them. I can't. I'm not the man you are. I don't belong here. Not only in this position. I don't know that I belong as a Radiant." Then this is Kaladin speaking. "I know the concern you show for each soldier. You're the person for this position. You're going to do a storming fine job of it, Sigsil, commander of the Windrunners." Having said it like that, Kaladin felt the final separation and found peace in it. I thought that was a really good final separation scene between Kaladin and Sigsil. I'd be willing to bet that Kaladin and Sigsil no longer, but that this is the last scene between Kaladin and Sigsil, or at least it certainly feels like that. So I thought that was a really cool thing to include here.
I agree. This was one of those really special scenes, really special Bridge Four moments. I have to say, my prediction on whether this would be the last time Kaladin and Sigsil see each other has changed, not because of how I feel about the scene, but because of my newfound understanding of the layout of this book. This book being over the course of 10 days, I don't think they will see each other again in these 10 days. I don't think we're going to have another moment where it's with all the calamity that is likely to happen, that we're going to see like a Sigsil and Kaladin catch up moment, you know? So I think you're right. And I think I would have predicted otherwise if that was not necessarily the layout of the book.
And I could maybe go on a limb and say they may meet again, but it would be after Sunlit. I could see that, but I think this would be the last time they meet until Sunlit Man and the things that Sigsil struggles with in Sunlit Man. This seems to set up pretty well.
Yeah, I can get with all that. I like Sigsil as the reluctant leader, actually. I think I've talked about this before. No, not quite sure exactly who it was, but some of the best leaders out there are those who don't want the power or responsibility of leadership. And
you were talking about Kaladin with the cloak from a couple episodes ago.
King Kaladin, yes. Right?
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. So this could be a little mini version of that, almost, of if Sigsel is, if he can bring to it the right attitude, which is exactly what Callan says here. He's like, you care about the people that you're leading. That's what makes you the right choice for this. That if you can have the right attitudes and understand like the core of what leadership is, even if you don't want it, those are some of the best leaders out there. And so I can get full on the Sigsel train of he doesn't want it, but it might be exactly where he needs to be. While we're talking Bridgefort, did you have any other big quotes, Trevor, we need to talk about, or I have a kind of a random question?
No, I was going to throw it to chapter 13, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Quick Bridgefort question for you. Does Drahi get completely run over by a bus here? There's a scene. There's a bit here where Kaladin is in the midst of all this, and he sits down his guys, his officers, and he says, you guys are all that's left. I'm not quoting. This is me paraphrasing. You three are all that's left. Oh, wait, no, here it is right here. I'll just read. Kaladin said, you three are all that's left of our original command structure. You, well, are among the best friends I have. And he goes on and on and on. He's talking to Sigsel, Scar, and Lopin and says, you're the only three left. Isn't Drahi from the original crew?
Yeah. I mean, Drahi was like a lieutenant.
He was named.
So in the original structure, when they get the Cobalt Guard spot in Words of Radiance, there's like four officers and like four lieutenants. And you're right. Drahi is getting the short end of the stick here because he's talking to two of his lieutenants, not even the original four officers. Because the original four officers are Sigsel, Rock, Moash, and Teft are the original four. And then the four below them are who he's talking to here. So, yeah.
And the line before, even, they're giving Lopin crap for not being there in the very beginning. Like the very, yes, very, very beginning of the Bridge 4 days, they're like talking about this. And Lopin's like, oh, yeah, the good old days. And they're like, you weren't even there when it first started because he joined later, remember, because it's a big deal that Kaladin picks the one-armed guy to be on his bridge crew.
Right.
And so, like, Lopin gets included in that, and Drahi doesn't?
Ouch. Yeah, justice for Drahi.
Yeah. Paul can't keep track of even Teft and Rock, so he's not counting Bridge 4 heads.
Yeah, if we want to throw fuel on the fire, I didn't realize that, Elliot. I didn't even pick up that they didn't include Drahi, so...
Anything else from 12?
That was it from 12 for me.
All right, chapter 13. So Shallan exits the Oath Gate, and we'll talk about the Shallan, Adolin, Kaladin, Syl like double date that happens here in a second, but we'll come back to that. Shallan exits the Oath Gate, and then she gets her armor. Her armor is like super excited. And actually, Paul, I want to throw this to you. Did you audiobook this chapter?
I did. These chapters, yes, I audiobooked these.
So, Elliot, I don't know if you get the full punch of this when you read it, because I read it and then listened to it on the preview chapters for this chapter. Shallan's armor spren are like, the way Kate Redding reads it, it's like two-year-olds learning their first word. They're like, Shallan, Shallan, Shallan. They're all like really happy and ecstatic to see her and then like form into armor and, you know, way overly ambitious about it. So Shallan gets her fourth ideal armor, which we can talk about her actual ideal here in a second. But her armor, it specifically says, has not been armor before. So it's a little new to this and almost chops her hair off. What do you guys think?
That was really fascinating. The thing you just mentioned of it's new to being armor, so it's not quite great at it about it yet. It almost chops her hair off. This aspect, I was like, okay, I understand that our Knight Radiance, you know, we've seen from the beginning dead shard blades and plate, where it's just like an object that you can have, you know, but it's dead, right? This live shard blades and shard plate. The plate I understand a little bit less of, but it's more live and it works with you. You know, we see our Radiants can summon their shard, their spren as a shard blade or a shard fork or a shard shield. Essentially what they need, the spren can adapt to. I'm assuming that's the same here or similar with our plate spren. But I was a little confused or surprised with this aspect of this plate spren that really doesn't know what's going on yet. They're like little teeny kiddos that are not sure, and they're kind of causing problems more so than... Because Kaladin has his plate moment, and it's like epic and cool, and this was more jovial and fun, which is awesome. I like that. But it seems very different. Is it different spren for the different Radiants? Or I was a bit confused logistically on that.
So we actually talked about this very thing in the previews. They are specifically different spren. Kaladin has wind spren as his armor. Shallan has creation spren, which if you actually think about it, she's been summoning creation spren since chapter one, when she's sketching Carbranth as she's sailing in. There's creation spren just following her around everywhere. What we kind of debated, David was not a big fan of armor spren not knowing how to be armor. He thought that was kind of lame, but I kind of took the counterside argument of Kaladin's armor. It's a perception thing. Kaladin knows how armor works. Therefore his armor is going to be prepared, well prepared. Shallan does not, therefore she doesn't, and she's going to have to coach her, and she's going to have to sketch out her armor. She talks about that, of I need to figure this out for myself so that my armor knows what to do. I think it's a Shallan thing, not necessarily the creation spren's fault. I think it's Shallan not really being familiar with wearing armor. That was my
take. Do you think hypothetically, if she had Radiant to wear the armor, that it would be more solid armor, perhaps?
Yes, I do.
Okay. That's fair. That's an interesting point. And with all the conversations we've had about spren, that does add up and make sense. I will say, I'm kind of glad to see Shallan is at her fourth ideal. I feel like I haven't known what ideal she's on for a while. It's been a bit ambiguous.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to be that they. I'm glad Brandon was like, by the way, Shallan is on her fourth ideal. Just for y'all who have lost track a little bit. By the way, she's on her fourth ideal. And that was very helpful. I appreciate it.
Exactly what it was. So
yeah.
I'm actually a little bit frustrated with it because Shallan doesn't even know what her ideal is. She comes out of Shadesmar and she's like, oh, I guess one of those truths I embraced back there was my ideal. And like, okay, hold on. We had like a couple epic lines back there. What I assume is her fourth ideal, you guys can argue for something else, is the line, I'm afraid of everything, terrified of the world, of what might happen to my family, most of all of myself. I always have been. And that is from chapter 9, I believe. And she's talking to Abidi, the monarch, and Radiant from within Shallan tells her that she said these words before, which would then imply that she was fourth ideal before debonding Testament, which is, we can have that conversation if we want, but
10 years old.
Yeah. She was fourth ideal, like, or maybe was this an earlier ideal for Testament and is now a later ideal for Pat? Shallan is weird. But yes, what ideal was Shallan before this? She was like 3 and also 4, but she forgot she was 4, and now she's 4 and 4, and now remembers that she's 4 on both. So there you go.
Yeah, it's really just that simple, Trevor. I'm glad you laid it out in such simple terms. I mean, the whole theory and situation of Chanarach potentially being Shallan's mother. If we want to talk about that, maybe that makes sense of somehow how she could understand these ideals from a young age. You know, maybe she was raised, and maybe she was fifth ideal with Testament. I have no idea, because Chanarach was a fifth ideal Radiant. So,
I don't know
how that could work, but it seemed like one explanation.
I wonder if we're going to get a scene of, like, Creation Spren shielding her from her mother. That'd be kind of cool.
That would be kind of... I'm actually curious. I have two big questions coming out of this. First is actually on the Spren, the Creation Spren that you just talked about. Is the Creation Spren... is the type of, like, lower Spren that becomes your armor unique to the person or unique to the order? Like, are all Lightweavers going to get Creation Spren armor? Or is it just Shallan gets Creation Spren armor? Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
What I believe is the consensus right now is, yes, we are assuming that each order has the same type of low Spren that become armor. Windrunners, Windspren, Lightweavers, you know, Creation Spren, Dustbringers, Flame Spren, you know, just throw out the equivalent of what your surges do, basically, and then that's your armor Spren. That's
okay.
I think that's a fairly safe assumption. Now, obviously, there's asterisks everywhere because we're in a Shallan chapter. So
yes, okay, and that makes sense. Yeah, Windrunners, Windspren. Yeah, I'm tracking. Yeah. Second big question is the ideal. You mentioned that I'm afraid of everything. I'm afraid of myself. I think that's my best guess as well. But also in that very same scene, very close to that, is where she delivers the line, reality is what I decide it to be. Which sounds rather oathy and truthy as well.
Yep. Yep.
Although, I'm not sure that jives with, like, her own journey. That I'm afraid of myself seems to fit better with her kind of journey that she's been on, which is why I'm thinking I'm leaning that direction. But how scary would it be if her fourth ideal was reality is what I decide it to be?
Ooh, maybe that's her fifth ideal and she set him out of order.
Oh, that, dear.
That's honestly something I was thinking of, Trevor. Like, jokes aside, like, that's really funny and all. But it could be, like we joked, I think, last episode about the end of the book. We'll see where it's like Shallan lets down her illusions and Roshar disappears or something really ridiculous like that. You know, it's like reality is what I decided to be. And then she, I don't know, reforms Aedor Nalsium or something ridiculous, you know. It's a bit wild. I don't know which of these it is. I think you're right in that the whole I'm afraid seems to be on par with her situation, but I have a feeling that it's more of this reality is what I decided to be in this whole leading into substantiation and things like that. I don't know. I've honestly had a bit of, so on one hand, I really like the Shallan chapters, this book, because it really gets us thinking and spinning ideas, debating. It's very engaging and exciting to read. But on the other hand, I feel like Shallan is so unique that I don't have the information that I want to know about the Lightweaver Order, about even bonding multiple Spren, like there's a lot of things, fortune, whatnot, that Shallan has kind of been the blanket catch for a lot of these things. And I've kind of struggled with that a little bit. I'm struggling with that now more in retrospect than whenever I actually read through the chapter. But that's because when you read through it, I feel like you know, we're not bouncing these ideas around as much. And so there's things. But I'm very... The Lightweaver ideals, these truths, have made sense, and this makes sense to me, but it doesn't seem clear. You know, and I kind of wish there was more clarity, but I think that's the point. I think the point is for them to not necessarily be specific and clear like the Windrunner oaths or Skybreaker oaths, you know. But I've had a little bit of a hard time with that. I want to see the fifth ideal for Shallan because I want to try and narrow down more, figure out more about Lightweavers and how this works. I don't know if y'all have had similar thoughts or contrary thoughts to what I'm saying, but I once again want to say that these Shallan chapters in this book have been among my favorites. Like they have been a big standout to me. But I'm just still lost with Lightweavers. I don't get it.
I'm right there with you. I'm a little frustrated with Shallan as our blueprint for Lightweavers. I feel like we almost need the Dawn Shard novella equivalent for Lightweavers. Like we need to see some Lightweaver oaths that aren't Shallan's so that we can then nail down exactly what we're talking about. Because Shallan is weird. We understand Shallan's weird. I get it. That's great. If we're trying to learn about Lightweavers, Shallan is not the one to go to. We need to go talk to whoever that Lightweaver guy that she left in Shadesmar just now was. Votha?
Wasn't Elokar going to be a Lightweaver?
Yes.
We needed Elokar.
True.
Not to make y'all sad, but...
Well, now that you say that, we could go talk to Hoid, but I feel like Hoid would also be a rough one to try to learn Lightweaver oaths off of.
That's fair.
It's like we need the alternate history novella that is what if Elokar didn't die and see him progress.
Maybe she could tap into that capital F fortune and show us. That'd be pretty wild actually, but I digress. But yeah, I had mixed feelings about that. I still don't know. I'm hoping it becomes more clear to us. What was the fourth idea? Like, he was specific in saying, yes, this was a fourth ideal. Like, Shallan is at the fourth ideal, but we still don't know which one it is exactly. We just know she said it recently.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right. We hop out of the Oath Gate. We go talk to Shallan, to Syl and Kaladin. And, Elliot, you get the first official bingo check on our bingo cards. Adolin has said... Honor is not dead.
Yeah.
So on Elliot's bingo card, for those of you who didn't watch that, he has someone says honor is not dead on his bingo card. And let me read the quote for you. I think he's always been optimistic, Adolin said. You don't jump in to save a doomed man unless you're optimistic. Honor is dead, Kaladin whispered. You were wrong on that point, though, Adolin said. Honor isn't dead. But honor isn't dead, Adolin continued, so long as it lives on in us. We'll go to the meeting without you, but we can meet at Jez's duty for a drink after.
I loved the throwback to that iconic moment. And I feel like we as fans very much appreciate those epic moments. It's nice to see our characters doing the same of that moment where Kaladin stands up and jumps into the arena with no shard plate, by the way, to go up against three attackers or something like that. That's beaten down on Adolin. It's cool that the characters are referencing back to that as well. And yes, a check mark on my bingo card. I am therefore now winning.
Congratulations. Except when we get to interlude 2, I'm going to make a hard argument for one of mine.
Oh,
I'm already going to decline it, and I haven't heard what you've said at all.
Fair enough.
Because you won't let us talk about Interlude 2 until the end.
Syl and Kaladin are hanging out at the Oath Gate that Shallan and Adolin jump through. They have a little, hey, nice to see you on the gas station passing by. You should come back to Yirithiru with us because we're going to go drop some news. Nope, that's actually where we just came from. We can't join you to Yirithiru. Bye. And they have the, hey, the four of us should go out for drinks when this is all over. And Syl was like, goes and holds Kaladin's hand and be like, and says, oh yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah. What'd you guys think?
I actually thought the scene was kind of cool in that Shallan is so insistent. Kaladin he tries to do the same thing he's done with every other character he said goodbye to, where he goes, oh, well, you know, Hoyt said I'm probably not coming back. So yeah, this might be the end. And most of our other characters have kind of taken that as, oh, okay, maybe this is the end. Shallan just immediately insists, no, you're going to say it. And we are building on this whole reality is what I make it thing. And she says, no, you say it. And he's like, fine, I'll say it. We will have drinks. We will go out for laughter and jokes when this is all said and done. And like that had a very weighty sense to it, almost as if like that might just now have to happen. Like they just spoke it into existence.
Shallan uses a very interesting phrase when speaking to Kaladin. And she uses the term reality warps around you. And coming from anyone else, I would think that's just you're special, you're Kaladin, you're Stormblessed. But given the conversation we just had about Shallan, is there something more to that sentence?
I'm starting to think there might be. Back to this whole like Kalak looking over her shoulder and going, "Oh, do you tap into fortune often?" And it's like, oh, does she? Like, what if this is that?
Yeah. Good question. Anything else on? Oh, I do have one more quote to read from this chapter. Basically, the last line of the chapter, or the last line of day one, is Kaladin speaking. Syl, I find I'm not worried. We are going to survive this, no matter what Wit said. We're going to have that drink with Adolin and Shallan. Which I thought was nice.
It is nice. Like we said, or like I've said at least, we've had an awful lot of hope and nice scenes surrounding Kaladin, and that both fills me with hope and fear for what is going to happen with Kaladin. A very large part of me thinks, for the first time, we might get happy Kaladin at Jez's duty, enjoying a drink with friends. Another part of me certainly thinks Kaladin is not going to make it past day two. You know, I have no idea.
Yeah. This is actually something I put in last week's outline, but we didn't get to. Everybody thinks Kaladin's coming back, except Wit. Hoyt is the only one who said, you're not coming back, explicitly says that. You're not going to be back in time to help Dalinar. And everybody else is like, nah, you survived the high storm. You're Kaladin. You'll be back, promise. Which way do you guys land?
I think prior to this chapter, chapter 13, I think I would have said that Kaladin was not coming back. But like we just said, with Shallan stepping in and like making a point to state it very clearly, you are coming back. Say it, Kaladin, you are coming back. That feels like it has power to me. And I feel like my answer changed after reading chapter 13, and I feel like Kaladin is going to come back. Now, I don't know who all else will be there when Kaladin gets back. So I think my prediction becomes Kaladin does come home, but that doesn't mean that the home he comes to is a happy place.
Hmm.
To put a nice dark spin on it, sorry.
I think that's fair. I do think that Kaladin is going to make it now. I don't think it's because Shallan has like power over reality at hand to, I mean, she says reality is what she makes it, but I don't think she does to, like, essentially will Kaladin to live. However, what we have seen Shallan do is put moments of inspiration into our characters, into some of the minor characters. And I could fully see that motivation or that spark being something that drives Kaladin to potentially survive something that would kill him. So I do think it is going to work out for Kaladin. I don't know what it's going to look like. I would not be surprised if he does not make it, but I think that would be my prediction of how it would really work out.
Did Shallan just give Kaladin some capital F fortune?
Potentially.
A smidge. Yeah, a smidge of fortune. It was the equivalent of, like, when you get a fortune cookie at the end of your meal. Like, just a nibble of fortune for Kaladin.
And it tells you to reap what you sow or something just vague, yeah, like that.
It says you will be asked an important question or something. Mm. Vague and unassuming.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. Roshar has a bit of a theme going of things are what you perceive them to be. The whole Spren, you know, exhibiting that very strongly seems to maybe be part of the core part of what Roshar is. If you think it hard enough, can you perceive these kinds of things into existence? It doesn't seem that far-fetched to me.
But Hoyt just said the passions are a load of crap. Doesn't matter how hard you want it.
That's true.
You still have to accomplish it by merit. It's not a will it into existence, at least from Hoyt's perspective.
True.
Anything else from part one or day one?
Well, that conversation actually teed up nicely what I wanted to talk about as a theme for all of part one, if you're ready for that.
Yeah. We haven't done themes since, like, Mistborn Era 1.
Yeah, I love this. I'm excited.
You're right. It has been a little while since I've done these. I did them for the Stormlight books, maybe a few others as well. I also realized that
I think you did them for Mistborn Era 1, and then they were all like, yes.
They were destruction,
doom.
Yes, they were, yes. Very dire in Mistborn Era 1.
Yes. Which, if you've read those books, you're nodding your head because you know exactly why. For when in truth, I've realized I've signed myself up to something a little bit more, and that I'm now facing 10 parts apparently in this book, so double the themes, I guess. For part one, I actually. This was a rather strange start to a book for me, and I can kind of explain why I think it's not what I expected, because my theme for part one, the word I can't shake, is farewell. That is like my takeaway from the start of this book, is we spent the entirety of day one with Kaladin saying goodbye to everyone. That is a weird way to start a book. Where they're saying farewell to everyone. And I'm doing a little bit of disservice to Shallan's side of this, although I can tie it in a little bit if I kind of bridge my farewell word over into something more like departure. I feel like Shallan isn't necessarily saying farewell, but she is starting to make some jumps. She's starting to make some leaps. She just said her fourth ideal. She's starting to break all these rules that we didn't even know existed. She seems to be maybe off on another journey that we weren't even expecting. Maybe not so much a physical, like, journey of distance, and one more of what magic is she capable of and how can she impact the world? Is she about to go over into the spiritual realm, right? Was part of what we talked about early on. So this sense of, like, embarking on a journey of finality is like my takeaway from part one, which is a rather strange way to start a book. Rather strange. And that's kind of it for my theme there, but I was going to keep rambling a little bit with it and say, I was actually curious about your guys' thoughts on the pacing of part one. This is, yet again playing into my like strange experience so far with this book, in that I feel like the pacing is very different from our previous Stormlight books. Things I key into specifically are like chapters that we jump back into when we jump, you know, back and forth with POV. They pick up like with the very next sentence of where we left off with the previous one. Like 0 seconds have passed in the time that we spent in like going from chapter to chapter, which I'm not used to. I'm not used to at all.
That's a Tress thing, actually. Tress always ended chapters with like a sentence and picked up the next chapter with the same sentence.
Yeah, you're right. But now we've got like multiple point of views, like kind of interweaving throughout that. And it actually made me think, I wonder if my strange experience with that pacing is because we're reading it so slowly. Like if you sat down and read the entirety of day one in one sitting, which I bet a lot of people are doing right now, it might flow a lot more naturally than for me, where I'm breaking it up so like intentionally, where the chapters are picking up with literally the next sentence from the past, but it's been a week since I read that chapter. And so it's a little bit strange for me, but maybe it, like 99% of people who are reading this aren't feeling like that. Those are my takeaways from part one.
I have noticed the change of pace. I feel like the closest we have is maybe the start of Words of Radiance. The start of Words of Radiance kind of picks up with some back-to-back scenes, that not like a farewell by any means, but some back-to-back scenes of setting up where we're headed for the book. Now that we are at the end of day one, we need to cover the epigraphs. I should remember that. But now that we're at the end of day one, we can see pretty well where this is going. So before the previews came out, I didn't think this would be over 10 days. I thought this would be the contest of champions would be over by part 3 of the book, and then we'd be trying to fight off whatever the repercussions of that are for the rest of the book, but not the case, apparently. Let me find the epigraphs real quick.
Elliot, I think Trevor's just trying to painstakingly make us wait to talk about interludes 1 and 2.
Oh, he is. He's dragging us out as long as he can to torture you on interlude 2 wait.
It's not enough that we had to read those and then put the book down. He now has to humiliate us by dragging us along even further.
It's his
by reading. Don't talk about it yet. Don't talk about it yet.
By reading from Knights of Wind of Truth. So we talked about this 2 weeks ago. I will pick up from where we left off 2 weeks ago. This is the interlude starting from chapter 8, and I'll go through the end of day 1. Her memory was keen, but her interpretation and explanation of that memory could be fanciful. Those days, though, I believe that she was deliberate, concerned, and focused. She did not see the future, but somehow knew it anyway. All agree, the first key moment came when Kaladin Stormblessed listened. Though not an edge dancer, he did a fine impression of their oaths. The second moment had happened already, when Zeth himself decided to take upon this quest, the one that would shape all of our futures. For while the contest of champions was to happen in the east, a different contest was to happen in Shinovar, and one that the wind swore was equally vital, perhaps more so. I was not with them. I did not know of their quest. Yet, I will do my best to recount their story, and that of the wind, for they were her champions. From Knights in Wind and Truth, page 11. Any thoughts?
Not a lot, to be honest. Maybe the biggest clue I pull out of there is the statement that, like, I was not with them, but I'll do my best to recount. That actually has like an implied I could have been with them to it. And so that actually narrows down like the number of characters in my mind of who this could be. it's someone who needs to clarify that I wasn't with them.
Well, there's a line in there that says, I didn't know of their quest, which I actually think disqualifies a lot of people.
I read that differently. How do you? I read that as, like, I didn't know of the details of their quest.
Okay. How's that?
Like, I knew full well they were on the quest, but I didn't know of it because I wasn't there. So this is a secondhand account of what happened.
Okay. So it could still feasibly be Yasna. Like, exactly. Somebody who knew of it, but it wasn't there. Okay. Yeah.
That's my take on it. And Yasna probably is my number one candidate at this point.
Yasna or somebody young who is growing up and then writes this is my one and then two candidate.
But door is still open to a lot of different things.
I agree. The door is still open. The author of this aside, I feel that these seem to be in line with a lot of the predictions or paths that we've gone down. The aspect we were talking about of Shallan using fortune to potentially keep Kaladin whole, I feel like that's enforced by this. I feel like a lot of it is. So I don't know if that is a good thing or if the rug's going to be pulled out from under us. I truthfully have no idea.
I've started doing something that I remember I've done in the past, and I don't remember exactly which interludes it was with, but we're being teased on purpose. Brandon is writing these ones like intentionally to seem very relevant to the story we're embarking on, but not actually feeding us any hard facts. And so actually because of that, I've stopped thinking very hard about them and just kind of gone, okay, yeah, it's a giant tease for where we're going with all this. I'm not actually going to get any information out of these. So I read them, I smirk, and I read on.
Do you remember which other interludes you did that with? Or epigraphs, I should say.
Because I
remember.
I don't remember, but I remember doing it multiple times where I started to check out from the epigraphs.
So the last time you did this was the Well of Ascension, where the epigraphs are quite relevant. And
that's true.
You read them and said, yes, I've read this before. Moving on.
That's true.
Where the epigraphs of the Well of Ascension are quite famous for being very important.
Fair enough.
Point that out.
Fair enough.
All right, Paul. We have finally arrived. Interlude one.
Perfect. So, I want to intro Interlude 1 by saying I really, really want to like Kalak. We get this Interlude 1 POV from Kalak himself, and he seems to be, thus far, our most cognizant, sane herald we've seen. You could maybe make arguments for others, but others we haven't seen as much, probably. I realize I am full and well influenced by his art. I think the Kalak art is my favorite Herald art.
It's good.
It's really good. And it's definitely like, you know, I tend to, you know, I like Zeth. I liked Zane in Mistborn. Like, you know, I have I realize it's an edgier art piece, and I think it's really cool. So I want to like Kalak. I really do. And I have hope that by the end of this book, we might like Kalak. He was kind of the cowardly character in Rhythm of War, sniveling kind of cowardly archetype.
And he still is. Let me throw that out there.
That is correct. He still is. Has been helpful to Shallan, which is a nice thing. He has not been he's not been an exemplary hero, but I'm hoping that by the end we might have a herald that we could actually root for or be, you know, be like, yeah, they're pretty cool. modern day, even. You could probably make that argument for Tom safely that he's really awesome, but you just can't even talk to him, so I don't know what to do about that. Essentially, so we see Kalak's perspective. He's getting into his little home. He's all paranoid, trying to lock it up, and then runs into Sion and Felt. Felt seems to command his mist cloak and entangle Kalak, holding him hostage. Pretty crazy. Allude to the book, in my opinion. I was pretty dumbfounded and engaged and really, like, jaw-dropped kind of, like, excitement. I listened to this interlude twice because I listened to it and then I rewinded it and listened to it again before I even did interlude two. I was just like, hold on. I want to hear this again.
I don't know why I was surprised by this, but Felt being a member of the Ghostbloods working for Kelsier seems so obvious, like extremely obvious, because Felt is the Mistborn, the Final Empire, like, spy dude that they talk to in the Final Empire. And he's Kelsier's informant in Luthadel. And I don't know if you guys remember this. I teased that for you guys on the podcast. Paul had read Mistborn at the time. Elliot, I read an excerpt from Mistborn before we even touched it to let you know that Felt was a Worldhopper. So why did I not see Felt being a Ghostblood coming? I definitely should have, but I
definitely hear you on that, Trevor, but it's still left field. It's still very much in the background. You have to really, like, as you come into this book and as you see these events unfold, you're not like, oh, when is Felt gonna hop into the fray? You know, it was a big surprise. And yeah, I was pretty shocked, and I definitely had to stop and think back, like, okay, hold on, Felt. Who's that again? You know? But yeah, so my understanding is Felt has now tied up, captured Kalak. He has a knife there, by the way. He has, like, the knife, like the Herald ending knife.
Yeah.
He kind of taunts that a little bit. It sounds like he doesn't fully plan to use it, but I'm a bit nervous for Kalak. I introed with, maybe we'll see Kalak. Maybe he'll be kind of a hero by the end and we'll get to root for him. It could very well be that next time we see, it's just there's no more Kalak. Like, he no longer exists. So, not sure. So Felt has him tied up, and is it Thydakar in the Sion? Is that what's going on here? I assume we see a Sion. I assume that equals Thydakar, but I don't remember for certain.
So that's the part that I wanted to talk about the most, actually, because Felt being the Ghostblood spy working directly for Kelsier, surprising, yes. I don't think I was ever going to guess that when it reveals, like, oh, okay, yep, makes perfect sense. Definitely a surprise. Where my jaw dropped, and where I was actually pretty upset with myself, was it seems to be pretty clear that the Sion itself was in on this. And this is the Sion that Mraes gave to Shallan, who then gave to Kalak.
Correct. Yep.
So the reveal here, as I take it, is that the whole time that, like, Shallan is using this Sion to talk to Hoid, it's just reporting straight to Kelsier, Thydakar, the whole time.
Yep.
And that is something that I should have thought about for sure. I think we maybe incorrectly relied a little too much on our Elantris knowledge and was thinking of Sions as, like, servants, that they're very obedient, tied servants to you. Very obedient. Very, like, they have a lifelong bond with a person kind of thing. they never betray the person. I don't know that that's actually honestly spelled out. That's just the takeaway I had from Elantris. So it could be wrong. So I never doubted the Sion itself for a second, but yet thinking back on that, that's an obvious, like, Kelsier has found a way to keep this Sion loyal to him, despite it being like linked or bonded or whatever to other people. That's kind of how I am now thinking of the situation. And that is, well, genius. I should have caught on to that.
Yeah, I agree. There's another dynamic here, inter-ghost blood, that I want to highlight. I'm going to read it. I was about to interrogate him, Alla, Felt said. There might not be a need, Alla replied. I've already relayed the information on Mishram's location to Yatil. And Lord Kelsier, Felt said. I don't work for that masked witch. Him as well, Alla said, obviously. The spren hovered around Kalak's head. Do we use the dagger? Something I want to highlight here. Felt is specifically saying, did you relay the information to Kelsier, not Yatil? And if you think back to Mistborn Era 2, there is some high tension between the Northern Continent and the Southern Continent on Scadrial. Felt is of the Basin. Yatil is of the Southern, what are they called? Malwish. Yatil's Malwish. So there's politics between the Ghostbloods on Roshar about Scadrial. So Yatil, like, having Kelsier as a religious figure, but Felt being sworn to Kelsier and not Yatil, and them working together, like, that's an interesting dynamic that I wanted to highlight in that one line.
The religious part of that is fascinating that I didn't think about too. You're right. Kelsier is a figure in the Malwish religion, which is...
And he's the survivor. He's also a... He's also in the Basin religion.
I took this as potentially evidence of our Ghostbloods on Roshar are actually going rogue. And that they are not necessarily acting in line with what Thydakar is wanting them to do. And so Felt maybe is loyal directly to Kelsier, whereas Mraes and Yatil may not be.
Yeah, I could get behind that.
Which,
anything else? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, one last thought to add on to that. We've wrestled. We started doing this when we read the last metal. Why am I starting?
The Lost Metal. Names?
Lost Metal. Thank you. When we read that, we started to wrestle a little bit with, like, do we like Ghostbloods or do we not? Because Ghostbloods on Scadrial seem to be fairly likable. Ghostbloods on Roshar, very not likable. If you want to try and defend Ghostbloods to me, I'll go back and read you some Ray's quotes where he's got some very dark motivations. And I wonder if, like, Felt actually in the scene a little ominous. I almost maybe am going to look for, like, is Felt maybe not a bad guy?
Well, and I almost wonder, could Felt actually be Kalak's ticket off Roshar?
Maybe.
Could Kalak, like, successfully get off Roshar with Felt, like, to Scadrial and be rescued from the other Ghostbloods? Yeah.
I don't trust or like Mraes and Yatil at all. I might be open to trusting Thydakar and Kelsier and by extension Felt, potentially.
Yeah. All right. Interlude 2. Odium. Just like to reiterate again, I am a big Terravangian Odium fan. You all can take it away from here.
I, too, am a very big Terravangian Odium fan. Trevor, you mentioned it from the beginning. Terravangian calls himself the Divided One. And I think that is so epic. Just that little detail is so epic and cool. but there's so much to back that up of why that is cool. So first, we see Odium. We see Taravangian as Odium. This is the first perspective we get of Taravangian post becoming Odium, right? Like the actual Taravangian perspective. The question that we've had is Taravangian still affected by this fluctuation between rigid logic, knowledge, enlightenment, and emotion? You know, his dumb days and his brilliant days, you know, and it turns out he is still affected by this. So here he is talking to none other than Corvelium Avast, talking to Cultivation herself. And this was not the conversation I was expecting to have as our first set of interludes right out of the gate. And I was elated, first of all, and so tuned in, so like I need to absorb accurately every word of this. Like, this is exactly the type of content I dream of getting in the context of our story. So we see this. I'm going to ask for y'all's help to break it down further. But essentially, my understanding is, you know, Taravangian is talking with Cultivation and kind of almost trying to figure out this whole shard thing. He's trying to do things, implement these things. He wants to do stuff, but she's like, oh no, you don't know anything about being a shard, do you? You can't do that, or you can't do this, or this. This leads to bad things, or, you know, things of that nature. Since Cultivation was the one who kind of got Taravangian, I briefly mentioned that there's theories that Cultivation is behind a lot of this, the major situation going on Roshar,
which is on my bingo card.
Yes, and that it was a bit planted that Cultivation has her touch on Taravangian via this whole waxing and waning of intelligence, and he is now in a shard position. I'm just going to stop there and let y'all take it away with thoughts you have to add or clarifications you have to add. There's a lot to unpack with this dynamic.
I thought there was a really cool conversation to start the interlude. Well, to middle the interlude. And it was Taravangian saying, I'm the god of passion. I'm the god of emotion. I could take away all this pain. And Cultivation says, you're right. You could. But what does that do? And they take it to the logical conclusion of no free will, no actual life on the planet, that life then becomes meaningless if there's no depth to it, if there's no contrast. So Taravangian then says, well, okay, you guys could do more. This is kind of back to the wax and harmony thing. Taravangian is always really frustrated with his position and tells Cultivation, you shards are cowards. You guys should do more, and I'm going to do more. I don't care, which I think is awesome. And the idea of, you know, the original shards are like, you know, let's not mess with each other. Let's all hang out over here, and you're over there. Well, that's great. We'll have our happy balance. And Taravangian says, no, absolutely not. I'm going to do what I see as correct, as right. Whether that's correct or right, we can have that conversation. But Taravangian says, you guys are too afraid to die to act. I'm not, so I'm going to. That's so cool.
That is, and that's what I was going to bring up, Trevor. Cultivation says, essentially, if you do what you're saying you're going to do, of overstepping shard boundaries or whatever it is, that leaves you vulnerable. You're breaking whatever pact it is that leaves you vulnerable to attack. It's sounding like if he does that, then she could take him out. She could take Odium out. That's a bit wild and extreme. And I think, really cool.
Whether I can get on the train of this is cool or not is going to hinge on interpretation of one key line. And I think, Trevor, you'll know this. I think this line was actually part of like the teaser video.
Yes, it was. They did
at Dragonsteel a couple weeks ago.
Yes,
they had this epic, like, lightning striking Michael Kramer reading epic lines from the books as like the official book release moment at the convention. Here's what Odium says. I know their anger cultivation. Do not lecture me. Oh, I taste it every moment. And I also know there will not be a way to soothe that agony. Not until what? She demanded. Not until there is but one God, Odium whispered. Do not go down this path. It destroyed your predecessor. I destroyed my predecessor, he said. Leave me. I am finished with your lessons. The line they stole for the teaser is, not until there is but one God.
No.
What does he mean by that?
Great question.
What he means by that line is the fulcrum that determines all of this interlude for me. Can I get behind the idea of screw you guys for being cowards and lazy? I'm going to step in and do something. What the do something is matters entirely.
Oh, yeah.
And the only hint of the do something that we get is the until there is but one God. There's a couple ways you can run with that. Is that destroy all the other shards so that I'm the only one left? Is that reform ad nauseum? What is it?
That we talked about this before on the other episode as well with Tim and David. There is a fine line here between Rays and Hoid. Hoid has the stated intention of reforming Ad Nauseam. Rays has the stated intention of being the only shard left. So, yes, which way does Taravangian interpret this? Is he going to go grab all the other shards and become Ad Nauseam? Or is he going to go kill all the other shards and become Odium? That's or so does, creepy and epic.
Yes. Or does that motivation or that decision of that viewpoint of there needs to be one God, does that fluctuate based off of his day? We're going to see 10 days. Are we going to get multiple days where we see maybe Taravangian having a different motive or a different goal, if that's the case? I think that would be sick. And I just certainly want to say that I love the character of Taravangian. I think the complexity and the intricacies of his character, I just think it's awesome. I don't know. I'm kind of gushing right now. I just think it's so cool. This premise that's been set up, how many ethical questions and discussions we've had with Taravangian over time that have hinged so much on whatever the heck day it is for him. And however the heck that's all going to play into our larger story. Like, depending on what side he takes with that, he could be the hero of the story. He could be the one who has killed Rays and worked Odium for a cause of good, which I don't think is going to happen, for the record. But so, hypothetically, I think there's a way you could swing that.
So here's the danger. And I love that this is the discussion that we're having. I think this is going to be fascinating if this is where the book goes. Could Taravangian become the hero of the story? That's a fascinating question. And the immense worry that I have in my mind is, up until this point, Taravangian and Dalinar have had a lot of conversations over the last four books. And over and over and over again, Tara Vanjian is like the poster child of the ends justify the means. That is his mantra. He is the opposite of journey before destination. And even when he has the exact right motive, the exact right goal, he tends to go about it in an incredibly evil way. Is that where we're headed? Where everything hangs on, can Taravangian reform Adonalsium or save the Cosmere, but it's going to come at this crazy evil cost and he's going to do it anyway? Like, is that where we're going?
I mean, I could fully see Taravangian enacting the whole deal that he made with Rays as Odium to begin with, of essentially, you can destroy everything, I will do my thing, and you save
Carbronth,
right? Yeah, you save Carbronth specifically. I could see it where he destroys everything and leaves Carbronth to uphold whatever deal he made, and he would view that as the fulfillment of the plan. You know, absolutely could see that, which would be wild. But yeah, I, more than anything, more, the one thing that I want to see more than like the Kaladin Zeth things going on, the Contest of Champions, for me, I don't even care anymore whose champion is who or what. I want to see Dalinar and Taravangian talk once again at the Contest of Champions. The way that it was set up in Rhythm of War, oh my gosh, I it's like crazy. It's overwhelming me thinking about it, because the way it's set up where they have these conversations and Dalinar is talking to Taravangian about, Dalinar is taking the point of, we're going to find a way to win this and save everybody. Taravangian is at the point of, we essentially need to give in to Odium and he will spare Carbronth, right? And Dalinar tells him, I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, I can't wait, we're going to embrace that day and I'm going to show you that you're wrong. And Taravangian is like, I hope you do. Like, I want to be wrong about this. Yeah. And then we have the major switcheroo of Taravangian becomes Odium. And ever since that point, I'm like, when are we going to get the conversation between Taravangian and Dalinar, where Dalinar realizes Taravangian is now Odium? Like, it's just so crazy. I could go on forever about it. It's to me the coolest plot point leading into this that I cannot wait. That's my most awaited for scene in the book.
Let me read the end of this interlude, because it's that there's some very fine details that I want to highlight. This is what Elliot read already. Not until what? She demanded. Not until there is but one god, Odium whispered. Do not go down this path. It destroyed your predecessor. I destroyed my predecessor, Odium said. Leave me. I am finished with your lessons. The divided one knelt and let himself feel. He was not Odium. He held Odium. He would not let it rule. He was not Odium. He was Taravangian. And he had an important mission, the same that he'd given himself years ago when he'd seen the threat to Carbronth, then had moved to save it. He was the one who could both see the coming danger and be willing to stop it. He was Taravangian, the divided one. He could save them all of them. Back to your good day versus bad day thing, Paul. I think he switches in the interlude. I think this is like a hyperfixation of that, of he is oscillating back and forth rapidly, but between Odium, I killed my predecessor, and Taravangian, I need to save them all. Like, I think this is fascinating.
I agree. This is, it's so cool. And I'm glad you read it. And what gave me so much hope and intrigue, this seeing this perspective is like the key moment as we look into the rest of the story. Like we said, we didn't know if Teravangi would still be afflicted by this fluctuating intelligence or what. We see this. We see him express that, like you said, your quote of he says, I hold the power of Odium, but I am Teravangian, right? Like that kind of goes hard, and that's really cool. And that provides me with inspiration or hope for his character. But like Elliot said, he tends to go about things in all the worst ways. He will get to hypothetically, if you wrote down only his goal, like do this goal. It's usually a good goal. Like you're like, okay, yes, I would like to do that thing. And then he does it and you're like, okay, not like this. It's exactly that. And I'm very curious to see. Right now he's saying, I can do something. I am waiting to see what it is that he is going to do. Like what it is, what his plan is.
So we have established a schism between cultivation and odium. It was theorized before this interlude that maybe cultivation and odium might be on the same side going into this book. I think we have thoroughly disproven that as cultivation walks away from odium. What's cultivation going to do? Is she going to be more active than she has been in the past, or is she not?
So cultivation seems to interpret that pivotal line in a specific way. That's the moment where she says, oh, okay, well, if you're still going to do the same thing, then I'm going to work against you. She seems to be going down the thought process of, okay, you're still out to kill all the other shards. So it almost feels like cultivation, her game plan hasn't really changed. Like she's delayed odium. She's stopped the destructiveness of Raze, has replaced him with Teravangian, kind of like setting Odium back a few thousand years. I've kind of hit reset on the clock. Odium's still trying to do the same thing, but isn't quite at the maniacal levels of Raze. So it almost feels like it's back to business as usual for cultivation, perhaps.
I have a feeling. Oh, go ahead, Elliot.
Well, I was going to pivot to Trevor's claim of his bingo card. Is this the part where he lobbies us for checking off part of his bingo card?
Oh, wait.
Yeah, I have a thought before I inevitably decline Trevor's request. Okay, my thought is with cultivation. So cultivation, we know, has had a touch on Teravangian, Dalinar, and Lift. We see this scene where cultivation is with Teravangian and they're talking. I think we're going to see, whether it's a chapter or a future interlude, I think we're also going to see cultivation talk to Dalinar and or maybe Lift. I think it'd be cool to see all three, like a Dalinar cultivation moment and a Lift, but I'm still not 100% certain how Lift will tie into things. So I'm not writing that one in pen. But I think we will see cultivation and Dalinar. That's my minor and also sort of major prediction. I think we will see that because also, you know, Dalinar's direct involvement in the Contest of Champions versus Odium. I'm very curious. We'll see what happens.
I know a little bit more than you guys do, so I will hold for a couple episodes before I predict. Anything else?
I don't think so. I think we've gotten a suitably epic kickoff to our interludes. These were some big ones.
All right. Oh, hold on. Hold. Next week is 232, and we are doing chapters 14 and 15, if you are reading along with us. So let's reconvene then. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
On we go.
See you next time.